Chapter 12. "Did you take my leg off?" Jeannot asked. His thin face was bloodless and white, like the wall of an old house. His freckles stood out very large and dark, as though they did not belong to his face, but were drops of paint sprinkled over it. The stump of his leg lay under a wire basket, over which the blanket was drawn. "Have you any pain?" Ravitch asked. "Yes, in my foot. My foot hurts very much. I asked the nurse. The old dragon wouldn't tell me." "The leg has been amputated," Ravitch said.
"Above the knee or below the knee?"
10 centimeters above it. Your knee was crushed and could not be saved."
"Good," Jeannot said. "That makes about 15% more from the insurance company. Very good. An artificial leg is an artificial leg, whether above or below the knee. But 15% more is something you can put into your pocket every month."
He hesitated for a moment.
"For the time being, you'd better not tell my mother. She can't see it anyway with this parrot cage over the stump."
"We won't tell her anything, Jeannot."
"The insurance company must pay an annuity for life. That's correct, isn't it?"
"I think so." His face twisted into a grimace.
"They'll be surprised. I'm 13 years old. They'll have to pay for a long time. Do you know yet which insurance company it is?"
"Not yet, but we have the number of the car. You kept it in mind. The police have been here already. They want to question you. You were still asleep this morning. They'll come again tonight." Jeannot deliberated.
"Witnesses," he said then. "It's important that we have witnesses. Have we any?"
"I think your mother has 2 addresses. She had the slips of paper in her hand." The boy became restless.
"She'll lose them. If only she hasn't lost them already. You know how old people are. Where is she now?"
"Your mother sat at your bedside all night and until noon today. Only then were we able to send her away. She'll come back again soon."
"Let's hope she'll still have them. The police..."
He made a weak gesture with his emaciated hand. "Cheats," he murmured.
"They are all cheats, in cahoots with the insurance companies. But if one has good witnesses... When will she come back?"
"Soon. Don't get excited about it. It'll be all right." Jeannot moved his mouth as if he were chewing something.
"Sometimes they pay the whole amount at once, a settlement instead of an annuity. We could start a business with it, mother and I."
"Now rest," Ravitch said. "You'll have time to think about it later." The boy shook his head. "You will," Ravitch repeated. "You must be rested when the police come."
"Yes, you're right. What shall I do?"
"Sleep."
"But then..."
"They'll wake you up."
"Red light. I'm sure it was a red light."
"Certainly. And now try to sleep. There is a bell in case you should need anything."
"Doctor?"
"Yes?" Ravitch turned around.
"If everything works out..."
Jeannot lay on his pillow, and something like a smile flitted across his twisted, precocious face.
"Sometimes one is lucky after all, isn't one?"
The evening was humid and warm. Tattered clouds floated low over the city. In front of Fouquet's restaurant, circular coke ovens had been set up. A few tables and chairs stood around them. Morozov was sitting at one of them. He beckoned to Ravitch.
"Come, have a drink with me."
Ravitch sat down beside him.
"We sit too much in rooms," Morozov declared. "Has that ever occurred to you?"
"But you don't. You're always standing in front of the Scheherazade."
"My boy, spare me your miserable logic. Evenings I'm a sort of two-legged door at the Scheherazade, but not a human being in the open. We live in rooms too much, I say. We think too much in rooms. We make love too much in rooms. We despair too much in rooms. Can you despair in the open?"
"And how?" Ravitch said.
"Only because we live too much in rooms. Not if one is used to the open. One despairs more decently in a landscape than in a two-room and kitchenette apartment. More comfortably, too. Don't contradict me. To contradict shows an occidental narrowness of the mind. Who actually wants to be right? Today is my day off, and I wish to absorb life. By the way, we also drink too much in rooms."
"We also urinate too much in rooms.
Get away with your irony. The facts of life are simple and trivial. Only our imagination gives life to them. It makes the laundry pole of facts a flagstaff of dreams. Am I right?"
"No."
"Of course not. I don't even want to be." "Of course you are right." "Good, brother. We also sleep too much in rooms. We've become pieces of furniture. Stone buildings have broken our spines. We have become walking sofas, dressing tables, safes, leases, salaries, kitchen pots, and water toilets.
Correct.
Walking party platforms, ammunition factories, institutes for the blind, and asylums for the insane. Don't keep interrupting me. Drink, be quiet, and live, you murderer with a scalpel. See what has become of us? As far as I know, only the old Greeks had gods of drinking and the joy of life, Bacchus and Dionysus. Instead of that, we have Freud, inferiority complexes, and the psychoanalysis. We're afraid of the two great words in love, and not afraid of much too great words in politics. A sorry generation.
Morozov winked.
Ravitch winked, too. Good old cynic with dreams, he said. Are you engaged in improving the world again?
Morozov grinned.
I'm engaged in feeling it, you romantic without illusions, for a short time on Earth called Ravitch.
Ravitch laughed.
For a very short time. This is now my third life, as far as names go. Is this Polish vodka? Estonian, from Riga, the best. Poor. And then let us sit calmly here and stare at the most beautiful street in the world, and praise this mild evening and casually spit in the face of despair.
The fire in the coke ovens crackled. A man with a violin took up a position by the curb and began to play Auprès de ma blonde. Passers-by jostled him. The bow scraped, but the man continued to play as if he were alone. It sounded thin and empty. The violin seemed to be freezing. Two Moroccans went from table to table and offered garish carpets of artificial silk. The newspaper boys passed with the latest editions. Morozov bought the Paris Soir and the Intransigeant. He read the headlines and pushed the newspapers aside.
"They're all damned counterfeiters," he growled. "Have you ever observed that we are living in the age of counterfeiters?"
"No. I thought we were living in the age of cans."
"Cans? How so?"
Ravitch pointed at the newspapers.
"Cans. We don't have to think any more. Everything is premeditated, pre-chewed, pre-felt. Cans. All you have to do is open them. Deliver to your home 3 times a day. Nothing any more to cultivate yourself or let grow and boil on the fire of questions, of doubt and of desire. Cans." He grinned. "We don't live easily, Boris. Just cheaply."
"Cans with false labels."
Morozov lifted the papers.
"Counterfeiting. Take a look at that. They build their ammunition factories because they want peace. Their concentration camps because they love the truth. Justice is the cover for every factional madness. Political gangsters are saviors. And freedom is the big word for all greed for power. Counterfeit money. Counterfeit spiritual money. The lie as propaganda. Kitchen Machiavellism. Idealism in the hands of the underworld. If at least they would be honest."
He crushed the newspapers together and threw them away.
"Very likely we are reading too many newspapers in rooms," Ravitch said and laughed. "Naturally. In the open one only needs them to start a fire."
Morozov stopped abruptly. Ravitch was no longer sitting beside him. He had jumped up and was pushing his way through the crowd in front of the café in the direction of the Avenue Georges V. Morozov sat for a second, astonished. Then he pulled some money out of his pocket, threw it onto a china plate beside the glasses, and followed Ravitch. He did not know what had happened, but he followed him anyhow, to be at hand if he should need him. He saw no police, neither did he see any plain-clothed detectives hunting Ravitch. The sidewalks were packed with people. Good for him, Morozov thought. If a policeman recognized him, he can easily escape.
He saw Ravitch again only when he had reached the Avenue Georges V.
The traffic lights changed at that moment, and the jammed lines of cars dashed forward. Notwithstanding, Ravitch tried to cross the street. A taxi almost knocked him down. The cab driver was furious. Morozov grabbed Ravitch's arm from behind and pulled him back.
"Are you mad?" he cried. "Do you want to commit suicide? What's the matter?"
Ravitch did not answer. He stared across the street. The traffic was very dense, car after car, 4 rows deep. It was impossible to get through.
Morozov shook him. "What happened, Ravitch? The police?"
"No." Ravitch did not take his eyes from the passing cars.
"What is it? What is it, Ravitch?"
"Harker."
"What?"
Morozov's eyes narrowed.
What does he look like? Quick, quick, Ravitch.
A grey coat. The shrill whistle of the traffic policeman came from the middle of the Champs-Élysées. Ravitch dashed across between the last cars. A dark grey coat, that was all he knew. He crossed the Avenue Georges V and the Rue Bassano. Suddenly there were dozens of grey coats. He cursed and walked on as quickly as he could. The traffic had stopped at the Rue Galilée. He rapidly crossed it and ruthlessly pushed his way through the crowd along the Champs-Élysées. He came to the Rue de Preuburg, crossed it, and suddenly stood still. Before him was the Place de l'Étoile, huge, confusing, full of traffic, with streets branching off in all directions. Gone. No one could be found here. He turned around slowly, still scrutinizing the faces of the crowd, but his excitement was gone. Suddenly he felt very empty. He must have been mistaken again, or Harker had escaped him a second time. But could one be mistaken twice? Could someone disappear from the surface of the earth twice? There were the side streets. Harker could have turned into one of those. He looked along the Rue de Preuburg. Cars, cars and people, people, the busiest hour of the evening. There was no point in searching along them. Too late again.
Nothing?
Morozov asked when he caught up with him. Ravitch shook his head.
I am probably seeing ghosts again. Did you recognize him?
I thought so. Only just a minute ago. Now I don't know at all. Morozov looked at him.
There are many faces that look alike, Ravitch.
Yes, and some that one never forgets. Ravitch stood still.
What do you want to do? Morozov asked.
I don't know.
What can I do now?
Morozov stared into the crowd.
Damn bad luck. Just at this time, close of business, everything crowded.
Yes.
And moreover the light, half darkness. Could you see him well?
Ravitch did not answer. Morozov took his arm.
Listen, he said, running around in the streets and cross streets is pointless. While you are looking through one street, you will think he is in the next one. Not a chance. Let's go back to Fouquet's. That's the best place. You can keep a better lookout from there than by running around. In case he comes back, you'll be able to see him from there.
They sat down at an outside table which was open to the street in two directions. For a long time they sat in silence.
What do you intend to do if you meet him?
Morozov asked finally.
Do you know yet?
Ravitch shook his head.
Think about it. It's better for you to know beforehand. There's no sense in being taken by surprise and doing something foolish, particularly not in your situation. You don't want to be imprisoned for years.
Ravitch looked up. He did not answer. He only looked at Morozov.
It wouldn't matter to me, Morozov said, if it were me, but it does matter to me in your case. What would you have done if he had been the one and you had got hold of him across the street at the corner?
I don't know, Boris. I really don't know.
You have nothing on you, have you?
No.
If you had attacked him without planning it, you would have been separated in a minute. By now you would be at the police headquarters, and he would probably have got away with a few black and blue marks. You know that, don't you?
Yes. Ravitch stared into the street. Morozov deliberated.
At best you might have tried to push him under an automobile at the intersection, but that wouldn't have been sure either. He might have got away with a couple of scratches.
I won't push him under an automobile, Ravitch replied without taking his eyes from the street.
I know that. I wouldn't do it either.
Morozov was silent for a while.
Ravitch, he said then, if he was the one and if you meet him, you must be dead sure what to do. You know that. You'll have only one chance.
Yes, I know. Ravitch continued to stare into the street.
If you should see him, follow him. But don't do anything else. Only follow him. Find out where he lives. Nothing else. All the rest you can work out later. Take your time. Do nothing foolish. Do you hear?
Yes, Ravitch said absent-mindedly and stared into the street. A man selling pistachio nuts came to their table. He was followed by a boy with toy mice. He made them dance on the marble tabletop and run up his sleeve. The violin player appeared for the second time. Now he wore a hat and played Parlez-moi d'amour. An old lady with a syphilitic nose was hawking violets.
Morozov looked at his watch. 8, he said. It's senseless to wait any longer, Ravitch. We've been sitting here for over 2 hours already. The man won't come back now. Everyone in France is eating supper somewhere at this hour.
Why don't you go, Boris? Why are you sitting around here with me anyhow?
That has nothing to do with it. I can sit here with you as long as we like, but I don't want you to drive yourself crazy. It's senseless for you to wait here for hours. The chances of meeting him are now the same everywhere. No, now they are greater in any restaurant, in any nightclub, in any brothel.
I know, Boris.
Ravitch stared into the street. The traffic had become less dense.
Morozov put his large, hairy hand on Ravitch's arm.
Ravitch, he said, listen. If you are destined to meet that man, you'll meet him. And if not, then you can wait for him for years. You know what I mean. Keep your eyes open, everywhere, and be prepared for anything. But otherwise, go on living as if you were mistaken. That's the only thing you can do. Otherwise, you will ruin yourself. I lived through the same thing once, about 20 years ago. I kept thinking I saw one of my father's murderers. Hallucinations.
He emptied his glass.
Damned hallucinations. Now come with me. We'll go somewhere and have something to eat.
You go and have something to eat, Boris. I'll come later.
Do you intend to stay here?
Just for another moment. Then I'll go to the hotel. I have something to do there.
Morozov looked at him. He knew what Ravitch wanted to do in the hotel, but he also knew that he couldn't do anything else. This was Ravitch's business alone.
All right, he said. I'll be at the Mère Marie, later at Boblishki's. Call me or come there.
He raised his bushy eyebrows. And don't run any risks. Don't be a hero for nothing, and a damned idiot. Don't shoot unless you are sure you can escape. This is no child's play and no gangster movie.
I know that, Boris. Don't worry.
Ravitch went to the Hotel International and started back immediately. On his way, he passed the Hotel de Milan. He looked at his watch. It was 8:30. He could still find Joan at home. She came toward him.
Ravitch, she said, surprised. You've come here?
Yes.
You've never been here, do you know that? Since the day you brought me here?
He smiled absent-mindedly. That's true, Joan. We lead a strange life.
Yes, like moles, or bats, or owls. We see each other only when it is dark.
She walked through the room with long, lithe strides. She wore a dark blue tailored dressing gown drawn tight about her hips with a belt. The black evening gown which she wore at the Scheherazade was lying on the bed. She was very beautiful and infinitely remote.
Don't you have to go, Joan?
No, not for half an hour. This is the best time for me, the hour before I have to leave. You see what I have? Coffee and all the time in the world. And now even you are here. I have Calvados, too.
She brought the bottle. He took it and put it unopened on the table. Then he took her hands.
Joan, he said.
The light in her eyes dimmed. She stood close to him.
Tell me at once what it is.
Why? What should it be?
Something. There is always something the matter when you are this way. Did you come because of that?
He felt her hands trying to pull away from him. She did not move. Even her hands did not move. It was only as if something in them wanted to pull away from him.
You can't come tonight, Joan. Not tonight, and perhaps not tomorrow, and not for a few days.
Do you have to stay at the hospital?
No. It is something else. I can't talk about it, but it is something that has nothing to do with you and me.
She stood there for a while, motionless.
All right, she said then.
You understand?
No, but if you say so, it is right.
You aren't angry?
She looked at him.
My God, Ravitch, she said, how could I ever be angry with you about anything?
He looked up. It was as though a hand had pressed hard on his heart. Joan had spoken without purpose, but nothing she could have done would have touched him more. He paid little heed to what she murmured and whispered during the night. It was forgotten as soon as dawn stood grey outside the window.
He knew that the rapture of those hours in which she crouched or lay at his side was as much rapture over herself, and he took it for intoxication and the shining avowal of the moment, but never for more. Now, for the first time, like a flyer who, through an opening of gleaming clouds on which the light plays hide-and-seek, suddenly perceives the earth below, green, brown, and solid, he saw more. He saw devotion behind the rapture, feeling behind the intoxication, simple confidence behind the rush of words. He had expected suspicion, questions, and lack of understanding, but not this. It was always the little things that brought revelation, never the big ones. The big ones were too tied up with dramatic gestures and the temptation to lie. A room, a hotel room, a few suitcases, a bed, light, the black solitude of night and past outside the window. And here a bright face with grey eyes and high brows and the bold sweep of the hair, life, pliant life, openly turned toward him like an oleander bush toward the light. Here it was. Here it stood, waiting, silent, calling to him. Take me, hold me. Had he not said a long time ago, I'll hold you? He stood up. Good night, Joan. Good night, Ravitch. He was sitting in front of the Café Fouquet. He was sitting at the same table as before. He sat there for hours, buried in the darkness of his past, in which only a single feeble light burned. The hope for revenge. They had arrested him in August 1933. He had kept two friends of his who were wanted by the Gestapo hidden at his place for 2 weeks, and he had then helped them to escape. One of them had saved his life in 1917 at Bichut in Flanders, and had brought him back under cover of machine-gun fire when he had been lying in no man's land, slowly bleeding to death. The other was a Jewish writer whom he had known for years. He had been brought up for examination. They wanted to find out in which direction the two had escaped, what papers they had on them, and who would be of help to them on the road. Harker had examined him. After he had fainted the first time, he had tried to shoot or strike down Harker with his own revolver. He had jumped into a crashing red darkness. It had been a useless attempt against four strong armed men. For 3 days, out of unconsciousness, slow awakening, out of frantic pain, Harker's cool, smiling face emerged. For 3 days, the same questions. For 3 days, the same body, bruised all over, almost incapable of further suffering. And then, on the afternoon of the third day, Sybil was brought in. She did not know about anything. He was shown to her to force a confession from her. She was a beautiful, luxury-loving creature who had lived a carefree, superficial life. He had expected her to scream and break down. She did not break down. She turned on the torturers. She used deadly words. Deadly for her, and she knew it. Harker had ceased smiling. He had cut short the examination. Next day he had explained to Ravitch what would happen to her in the concentration camp for women if he did not confess. Ravitch had not answered. Harker had explained to him what would happen to her before that. Ravitch had not confessed to anything because there was nothing to confess. He had tried to convince Harker that this woman could not know anything. He had told him that he only knew her superficially, that she had meant little more in his life than a beautiful picture, that he could never have confided anything to her. All this had been true. Harker had only smiled. 3 days later, Sybil was dead. She had hanged herself in the concentration camp for women. A day later, one of the fugitives was brought back. It was the Jewish writer. When Ravitch saw him, he could no longer recognize him, not even by his voice. It took another week before he was finally dead under Harker's examination. Then came the concentration camp for Ravitch, the hospital, the escape from the hospital. The silver moon stood above the Arc de Triomphe. The street lamps along the Champs-Élysées flickered in the wind. The lights of night were reflected in the glasses on the table. Unreal, Ravitch thought, unreal the one and the other. Unreal these glasses, this moon, this street, this night, and this hour that touches me with its breath, strange and familiar as if it had been here before, in another life, on another star.
unreal these memories of years that are past, submerged, alive and dead at the same time, only phosphorescing now in my brain and petrified into expectation. Unreal this fluid rolling through the darkness of my veins, unresting, 98.6 in temperature, slightly salty in flavour, 4 litres of secrecy and drive, blood and the reflection in ganglia, the invisible storehouse in nothingness called memory. Star after star, rising year after year, one bright, the other bloody as Mars above the Rue de Berry, and many darkly gleaming and full of spots, the sky of memory beneath which the present restlessly carries on its confused life. The green light of revenge. The city quietly floating in the late moonlight and in the drone of automobile motors. Long rows of houses stretching endlessly, rows of windows and packed behind them bundles of fate by the block. The heartbeat of millions of men, the incessant beat as of a millionfold motor moving slowly, slowly along the street of life, with every throb a tiny millimeter closer to death. He got up. The Champs-Élysées was almost empty. Only a few whores loitered at the corners. He walked down the street, past the Rue Pierre-Charron, the Rue Marbeuf, the Rue Marignan to the Rond-Point, and back to the Arc de Triomphe. He stepped over the chains and stood before the tomb of the unknown soldier. The small blue flame flickered in the shadow. A withering wreath lay in front of it. He crossed the Étoile and went to the bistro where he thought he had first seen Harker. A few taxi drivers were still sitting there. He sat down by the window where he had been sitting before and drank his coffee. The street outside was empty. The drivers were talking about Hitler. They found him ridiculous and prophesied his immediate downfall should he dare to come near the Maginot Line. Ravitch stared into the street. Why am I sitting here? He thought. I could be sitting anywhere in Paris. The chances are the same. He looked at his watch. It was just before 3. Too late. Harker, if it had been he, would not be roaming the streets at this time. Outside he saw a whore strolling around. She looked inside through the window and walked on. If she comes back, I'll go, he thought. The whore came back. He did not go. If she comes once more, I'll certainly go, he decided. Then Harker is not in Paris. The whore returned. She beckoned with her head and passed by. He remained sitting. She returned once more. He did not go. The waiter put the chairs on the tables. The cab drivers paid and left the bistro. The waiter turned off the light above the counter. The room was plunged into murky darkness. Ravitch looked around. The check, he said. Outside it had become windier and colder. The clouds floated higher and faster. Ravitch walked by Jones' hotel and stopped. All was dark except one window where a lamp shimmered behind curtains. It was Jones' room. He knew that she hated to enter a dark room by herself. She had left the light on because she was not coming to him today. He looked up, and suddenly he no longer understood himself. Why didn't he want to see her? The memory of the other woman had died long ago. Only the memory of her death had remained. And the other thing? What did it have to do with her? What did it still have to do even with himself? Wasn't he a fool to chase an illusion, the reflex of an entangled, blackened memory, a dark reaction? To begin anew stirring the dross of dead years, stirred up by mere chance, by an accursed resemblance? To allow a piece of the rotted past to break open again, the abscess of a barely healed neurosis, and thereby jeopardize everything he had built up in himself, his own self, that clear bit of life divorced from what he had been, the life he had created for himself and the only person close to him? What had the one to do with the other? Hadn't he taught himself that time and again? How else could he have escaped, and where would he be without it? He felt that the lump of lead in his brain was melting away. He breathed deeply. The wind came along the street with swift blasts. He looked up at the lighted window again. There was someone to whom he meant something, someone to whom he was important, someone whose face changed when she looked at him. And he had been about to sacrifice that to a twisted illusion, to the impatient, disdainful arrogance born of a faint hope for revenge. What did he really want? Why did he resist? What was he saving himself for? Life offered itself to him, and he raised objections, not because there was too little, because there was too much. Had the bloody thunderstorm of his past to sweep over him that he could recognize it? He moved his shoulders. Heart, he thought. Heart. How it opened itself up. How it throbbed. Window, he thought. Lonely window lit at night. Reflection of another's life that had given itself up to him passionately, waiting, open, until he too should open. The flame of love. The St. Elmo's fire of tenderness. The bright, swift sheet-lightning of the blood. One knew it. One knew everything about it. One knew so much that one thought this soft, golden confusion could never flood one's brain again. And then suddenly one night one stood in front of a third-rate hotel, and it rose like mist out of the asphalt, and one felt it as though it had come from the other end of the earth, from blue coconut islands, from the warmth of a tropical spring, as though it had filtered through oceans, coral reefs, lava, and darkness, and impetuously pierced its way into Paris, into the shabby Rue Poncelet, with the odor of hibiscus and mimosa, in a night filled with revenge and the past, the irresistible, indisputable, enigmatic resurrection of emotion. The Scheherazade was crowded. Joan was sitting at a table with some people. She saw Ravitch at once. He remained standing by the door. The place was full of smoke and music. She said something to the people at her table and came up to him quickly. "Ravitch, are you still needed here?"
"Why?"
"I want to take you with me."
"But didn't you say—"
"That's over. Are you still needed here?"
"No. I'll just tell them that I'm going."
"Do it quickly. I'll wait for you in the taxi outside."
"Yes."
She remained standing.
"Ravitch."
He looked at her.
"Did you come because of me?"
she asked. He hesitated a second.
"Yes,"
he said in a low voice while her face moved close to his.
"Yes, Joan. Because of you. Only because of you."
The taxi drove along the Rue de Liège.
"What was the matter, Ravitch?"
"Nothing."
"I was afraid—"
"Forget it. It was nothing." She looked at him.
"I thought you would never come again."
He bent over her. He felt her trembling. "Joan," he said, "don't think about anything and don't ask any questions. Do you see the light of the street lamps and the thousand-colored signs out there? We are living in a dying age, and this city quivers with life. We are torn from everything, and we have nothing left but our hearts. I was in the land of the moon, and I've come back. And here you are, and you are life. Don't ask anything more. There are more secrets in your hair than in a thousand questions. Here before us is the night, a few hours and an eternity, until the morning rumbles against the windows. That people love each other is everything. A marvel, and the most obvious thing in the world. This is what I felt today when the night melted away into a flowering bush, and the wind smelled of strawberries, and without love one is only a dead man on furlough, nothing but a scrap of paper with a few dates and a chance name on it, and one might as well die." The light from the street lamps swept through the window of the taxi like the circling beam of a lighthouse through the darkness of a ship's cabin. Joan's eyes were alternately very translucent and very dark in her pale face.
"We shall not die," she whispered in Ravitch's arms.
"No, not we. Only time. Damned time. It always dies. We live. We always live. When you wake up it is spring, and when you go to sleep it is fall, and a thousand times in between it is winter and summer, and when we love each other enough we are immortal and indestructible, like the heartbeat and the rain and the wind, and that is much. Day by day we are conquerors, beloved, and year by year we are defeated. But who wants to realize that, and to whom does it matter? The hour is life. The moment is closest to eternity. Your eyes glisten. Stardust trickles through infinity. Gods can age, but your mouth is young. The enigma trembles between us. The you and me call and answer out of evenings, out of dusks, out of the ecstasies of all lovers, pressed from the remotest cries of brutal lust into golden storms. The endless road from the amoeba to Ruth and Esther and Helen and Aspasia, to blue Madonnas in chapels on the road, from jungle and animal to you.
to you. She lay in his arms, motionless, her face pale, in such surrender that she almost seemed absent. And he bent over her and spoke, and at the beginning he felt as though someone were looking over his shoulder, a shadow that talked soundlessly too, with a faint smile. And he bent deeper and felt her move toward him, and it was still there, and then it was gone.